The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Americans throw away more than 250 million tons of waste each year, a number that makes any individual attempt to rein in waste feel minuscule. Well, the Post Landfill Action Network, or PLAN, is rallying college students to make a real dent. In 2010, PLAN started collecting the discarded books and furniture and electronics heaped into dumpsters when UNH students moved out of their dorms. They found a place for storage over the summer and then resold the goods at a discount to new students on move-in day. The PLAN methodology is now operating on 48 campuses across the country, and its innovative strategies for growth and funding has earned startup money and awards and recognition from business and environmental organizations all over the country. Alex Fried is with us. He's founder of PLAN. Welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So, Alex, how did you make this happen? How did you get buy-in from UNH and Durham to collect all of this material?
We started this whole thing as a group of students. The program at the University of New Hampshire, which is still in place today, is called UNH Trash to Treasure, which is a student-led program on campus. So as a group of students that were interested in creating an initiative that not only could solve a problem at UNH, but also could be used as a national model to expand out to campuses across the country, we just started with having individual conversations with administration on campus, talking with folks in sustainability, in housing, res life, you know, campus planning, facilities, all the different kind of departments on campus that play a role in waste management and figuring out the logistics for a program like this.
So that first sale, how much material did you have to work with?
The numbers that we were running with were that in the average month, students threw away about 25 tons of trash. In the month of May, during move-out, students would throw away about 105 tons.
Wow.
So we were looking at about 80 extra tons of usable materials like furniture and electronics.
Wow. So how did you stage this thing?
You know, our goal was figuring out the main logistics of the program. So when we collect stuff, where do we store it? Once we're storing it, where are we holding a yard sale? How do we rent trucks? How do we set up storage containers on campus? Which departments are we able to work with? So it took months. It was a lot of planning, a lot of negotiating with administration. It takes a lot for administrators to trust students to run their own programs. And there's a lot of good reason for that because, you know, students are transient. They graduate. And when you give students a lot of responsibility, that responsibility can fall through when they have other responsibilities like their family, their friends, schoolwork, you know, running jobs outside of school, et cetera. So it took a lot of trust and a lot of relationship building. But we were able to work with administration to get the permission to set up drop-off locations in dorms and then collect everything when students moved out, store everything in various storage locations around the campus over the summer, and then hold the yard sale during move-in weekend.
Any snags? Any resistance?
A lot of snags. The reality is that it does come down to relationships. So there were many campus administration officials in various departments that were wonderful, that we still have incredible relationships with, that we loved working with since day one. There were others who were resistant for various reasons and for good reason. One of the biggest challenges that we faced was after getting 7 campus department officials to sign off on the permit for the yard sale, the chief of police for the University of New Hampshire denied the permit.
What'd you do?
So we asked him for a meeting, and a couple weeks later, we were able to sit down with him. And we started by asking him the basic question of, why did you deny the permit? And through an hour-long conversation, we discovered a lot of things that honestly were good points. He had good reason for denying the permit. Move-in weekend is the most hectic weekend on campus. The university police call in extra police from around the state to help them with shutting down roadways, shutting down parking lots, managing the traffic on that day. He was concerned that bringing a large yard sale into the middle of that chaos would be impossible and cause many problems. So we worked with him to figure out how we could do that effectively and work together. And worked out many small solutions, like things like, all of our volunteers had to have bright orange T-shirts so he could identify us. We had to set up a system for picking up furniture and other large items, and also delivering furniture and other large items after the sale, so that there wasn't a large amount of traffic flow throughout the day. And at the end of the meeting, he said, you know, I'm still really concerned about this, but I really appreciate your approach, and I'm willing to give this a shot. A couple of years later, we sat down with him again, and he said one of the most inspiring things that I've ever heard, which was he said, you know, working with you has completely changed the way that I work with students. So whenever students come to me with an idea that I have concerns about, instead of just denying that program outright, I ask them to come in for a meeting, and I talk with them about my concerns. And if we can work out a negotiated solution, I'm willing to move forward with that.
Well, it's really impressive. And I think that's one of the reasons that you've been recognized by so many people and that this is now on 48 campuses.
Yeah.
Have you ever calculated how much you've probably saved from landfills?
At the University of New Hampshire, in the last 5 years, the program has now been in place for 5 years, we've diverted about 150 tons of usable material.
Wow.
For the 48 campuses that we are now working with, which we worked with 9 campuses in our first year and now 48 campuses in our second year of being a national organization after 2013. So in the last 2 years, we've worked with campuses to divert close to 225 tons in total across 2 years.
Can anybody buy, or is it just students at these sales?
So it depends on the campus. So at the University of New Hampshire, the program is open to the public, with the exception of being able to drive to campus, like if you park off campus or if you walk to campus. But at some other campuses, like, you know, in the heart of a city, can be a little bit more closed just because it would be so chaotic to have it be open to the public. So each campus is different.
Well, I know you've been recognized for the environmentally sound practices, but also for innovating on nonprofit funding models and growing your business. Now, what are some of the things that have given you that innovative stamp?
So in the early stages of starting up this organization, you know, I came at it from the perspective of I was a student that was graduating the University of New Hampshire, and I had started something that was successful and replicable, and we wanted to turn that into a nonprofit. But a lot of people told us that this was, you know, a real pie-in-the-sky vision to start a nonprofit organization that had national scope. And there was a lot of promise to it, but it was also obviously a huge challenge. And one of the biggest challenges in the world of nonprofits is sustainable long-term funding. So there's lots of early-stage funding, you know, idea competitions, business plan competitions. But, you know, you get that early-stage funding of $50,000 or $100,000 because you win something, and then you have to find renewed funding after year two, year three, year four. And oftentimes those grants aren't readily available. So we've started to engage many different companies. You mentioned Penske as an mm-hmm. example. We help campuses establish programs that ultimately require many contracts, including renting trucks. Mm-hmm. So we approached Penske Truck Rental, and we asked them to establish a national rental account. And under our national rental account, we're able to provide a significant discount to the members in our network. So campuses in our network get access to a 35% discount on renting trucks. And then we're also able to establish a rebate back to our organization for having brought business to our partner companies. So as an organization, we have sustainable long-term funding, not only from the work that we're doing on campuses, but also from the partnerships we're establishing with our partner companies.
What does environmental activism look like today? Well, we're getting just a glimpse with Alex Fried. He's founder of PLAN. That's the Post-Landfill Action Network. They are tackling the waste problem one campus at a time. It started at UNH, recycling goods thrown away at the end of the year by students and then resold to students the next year. It's now at 48 campuses around the country, and they're looking for 500 by 2020. You were a philosophy major at UNH,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
How did you figure this out? And what was your approach to putting together a business model for starting a national organization?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, for us, it's the ability to be like tenacious, to explore ideas, to really get down into the details of what this could look like and be willing to try and fail and pivot. So all of those things have made it possible for us to get to where we are today. But in terms of, you know, my philosophy background, that really informs a lot of my background approach to the work that we're doing. You know, as a philosophy major, I studied issues of you know, marketing and how society interacts with stuff, how like people as human beings interact with value in terms of goods or materials. Why is it that more than 50% of the products that we buy on a daily basis, we throw away within 24 hours? Mm. Why don't we value these resources as commodity resources that we're extracting from the earth to make consumer goods, to then throw them away within very short lifespans? A lot of it has to do with, you know, consumer marketing and branding. And a lot of it has to do with kind of the way that we've been socialized. So for me, the philosophy background is in, you know, my approach to these global issues and why I think that there is a need for a student-led movement around these solutions.
Hmm. Well, you are also, you're leveraging social media. You're working with businesses, national businesses, targeting partnership. I mean, it sounds like very sound contemporary startup practices. But there are people who, you know, would criticize you for you're working with Toms of Maine. That's owned by Colgate. I mean, there are activists from the old days who would never do that kind of thing. And I'm just wondering how you balance it. Any lessons that you've drawn from the environmental movements of the past or of how business startup culture works?
Yeah, that's a great, really great question. We're very open with our funding sources as well as, you know, our decision making capacity and why we choose to work with certain companies over others. So, you know, Toms of Maine is an example. They're owned in terms of a percentage of their stock by Colgate-Palmolive, but they're also heavily influencing the work of Colgate-Palmolive because they're so successful as a company. So their business practices are being run up the chain to larger corporations because their impact is so high. The other thing is that, you know, companies like Toms of Maine have retained their independent corporate charters. So when they say, you know, we source from 100% organic products, we have a commitment to zero waste, they've come out with a commitment for their factories to be zero waste by 2020. So, you know, we're happy to be working with companies that are part of the solution. There are other companies that we will draw a line at that we're not interested in working with. You know, extractive industry companies, many like bottled beverage type companies. In terms of opportunities for partnerships that we can establish, there's a lot of companies out there that do unique recycling efforts, like electronic waste recycling, styrofoam recycling, carpet recycling, mattresses, etc. But there's also lots of opportunity for us to work with sustainable brand companies. So, you know, it's not just Toms of Maine, but there's also companies like Clean Canteen or Chico Bag or Patagonia or other really interesting companies out there that have clearly stated values to work towards zero waste, to be aware of their impact, to focus on redesigning their products, redesigning their packaging to make them more recyclable or reusable at the end of their life. So as we see companies moving in this direction as well, there's a huge opportunity for those companies to support the student-led movement on these campuses. And there's a huge opportunity for the student-led movement to work with these companies hand in hand to say these are the companies to support because they're the ones that are changing the industry for the better and they're creating the opportunity for us to all work towards a zero-waste world.
Well, many people do discover activism when they're in college and, you know, they're creating their identity, right?
Yeah.
How do you train people then to make that jump to post-college activism and carrying on as, you know, people engaged in their civic processes? Is that something that you work with?
Yeah. So I think, you know, from our perspective of having been student organizers and then seeing all of our friends who are student organizers and traveling around the country and working with students across the country, being our age, being, you know, young 18 to 22-year-olds in the time that we're in right now, this may not necessarily be different for any generation at that time period, but it's a really daunting thing to kind of grow up and become aware of the world and become aware of all of the problems in the world kind of all at once, especially in college. And it's overwhelming and it can be disempowering or disenfranchising. And we see a lot of students that kind of have this mentality of, okay, there are these things that I can solve, and they get involved at a very heavy level, and then they kind of burn out, and then they fade away.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really important to harness that energy at the time that it's developing and help individuals develop like a long-term perspective for how to be involved and how to create change. So a lot of the advising, a lot of the training that we do with students is in helping them have early stage success. Because that early stage success is something that they can build off of for the rest of their lives, and they can see their impact and feel like they actually do have the ability to create change. It creates that agency within individuals. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the global waste crisis, when you look at, you know, 5.25 trillion pieces of plastic in the ocean, that can feel really daunting. But we also try to take it down to that local level story where you can be involved in the solution on your campus. You can create change that can be replicable. You can have a story that can be inspiring to others.
Yeah.
So in terms of carrying that on to after graduating, you know, we see a lot of students take these solutions to their businesses that they work with. We see a lot of students come up with innovative ideas where they start their own businesses or they get involved in, you know, any aspect of things, whether it's marketing or whether it's engineering. You know, there's lots of ways that you can make a difference in the world of electronics or in the world of styrofoam recycling or any number of other, you know, you can be an environmental science individual working on composting programs for a city or a state. There's so many places that you can take that agency and apply it to other opportunities to have impact in the world.
Well, Alex Fried, thank you so much for giving us a little jolt today.
Thank you.
Alex Fried, he's founder of PLAN, that's the Post Landfill Action Network, and you can find much more on PLAN, including a very inspiring video that shows what they do. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Vladimir Popov is known around Waterville Valley as the opera-singing chairlift operator. Although Popov strings strictly in the mountains now, as he told NHPR Sean Hurley, he once sang in the world's great opera houses.
At the Ski Mountains Base Lodge, cashier Jean Brousseau says she heard Vladimir Popov singing earlier, but she's not sure where he is now. She loves to hear him sing, she says, even though in the 15 years he's worked here, she's never understood a word of it.
It's all in Russian and Latin or Italian or something. I would really love to hear him sing Silent Night or Oh Holy Night in English. Can you imagine that?
Brousseau directs me outside. Go find Butch, she says. He'll know where Popov is. I find Butch Cushing near the snow machines. In charge of lift operations, Cushing sent Popov to the high country lift today.
When you get to the top?
Yeah.
Just go to the next lift. He'll be at the base of that next lift.
Cushing escorts me to the lower lift and waits as my chair comes around.
Sometimes, you know, even the people from his country will come and they recognize him. I had one come up to me and said, do you know who's running that J-bar?
It's a 10-minute ride, and when I get to the top, I don't need to ask for directions. A group of snowboarders glide in toward Popov. After they're away, Popov squints at me from a distance. He knows why I'm here, but he's wary. The last story about him didn't turn out well.
4 years ago, they come in here. They asked me singing. They published it. This is not ask me nothing. And the guy make me like loser. Why is this guy doing in the mountain after a career like this?
Usually, the story goes the other way. The unknown singer gets a break and leaves behind the little job in the mountains. But the retired tenor says he's never been happier. He's outside, he's in the mountains. He sings when he wants.
I start singing very young, yeah. Because my mother have a good voice. Yeah. And later I go Soviet military. And I go study after military, I go like a study in conservatory.
He studied for 6 years before winning a coveted spot in the Bolshoi Opera. And then, in 1982, while studying at La Scala in Milan.
I defected actually, not immigrated, defected.
In jeans and a t-shirt, he walked into the American consulate.
Oh, this is scary stuff. I don't expect it myself, too.
After the initial interview, Popov was told he could return to his hotel and someone would be in touch.
I said, where I go? Yeah. I go outside? Maybe KGB wait for me already, you know?
What happened then?
They let me stay inside.
Oh, okay.
Consulate, you know? And guy gave me actually a case of beer because my birthday... I defected. Budweiser, I remember, Budweiser. Yeah.
3 days later, Popov was flown to New York, put up in a hotel, and given $40.
I make an audition immediately. City Opera take it me for opening season, Tosca. Yeah. Metropolitan Opera take it me, and Lorin Mazel. But I said, Metropolitan Opera, I'm here.
Here's a 1991 recording of Popov singing in Mussorgsky's Covanchina with Claudio Abbado conducting.
This kind of a life of the opera singers. Travel, travel, travel. But I see the whole world. The four opera imported in the world. La Scala, Metropolitan Opera in New York, Royal Opera Covent Garden in London, and Vienna State Opera.
During the 18 years that followed his defection, Popov sang in all those great opera houses. He met and married Lucy, whose family connections in New Hampshire resulted in the move to Waterville. But, he says, a career in opera is a lot like a career in Hollywood. And so in 2000, when he was 54, Popov retired from singing and took a job at the ski mountain.
People like it, this go on the lift, my voice travel far away. The girls were only today, she coming from the top, said, hey, Vladimir, I heard you up there. Yeah.
And as opposed to the more formal divide of the stage, here on the mountain, skiers can approach him when he's done and let him know what they think.
And he started singing, and I turned around and I just immediately gave him a hug because I was crying at the time. It was beautiful.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The musician known as Enya sailed this song to the top of the charts in 1988. She's gone on to sell 80 million albums. That is five times as many as Beyoncé, without ever touring, courting the press, or sending a single tweet. Anne Helen Peterson profiled Enya just as her first album in 7 years was about to be released. She writes that Enyanomics is now a term used among MBAs and that Enya has become her own adjective. Anne Helen Peterson, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So it may not come as a big surprise that Enya lives in a castle. Where?
She lives in a castle about 45 minutes an hour south of Dublin in what some people call the Riviera of Ireland. It's overlooking the sea, and she lives right next to Bono. She looks over on Bono's house. Her castle is bigger than Bono's mansion, and it's just a gorgeous part of Ireland.
So bigger than Bono's, how much is she worth?
She's worth hundreds of millions of dollars. She's on the most wealthy celebrities in the Sunday Times of London. Out more money than, say, Chris Martin of Coldplay. And she, I mean, her castle looks like a real castle. Like, it has turrets. You walk by it and you think that is a castle.
So what does this term Enyanomics that you found mean?
Well, so this term is used, you know, she was asked to actually come speak to an MBA class about her very unique success, which they termed Enyanomics, in that most artists today don't make as much money from selling albums, or the way that they sell albums is by keeping their visibility up by touring, by making public appearances, that sort of thing. And Enya's albums sell without most people even knowing anything about her. She doesn't tour. She does very few interviews and only around the release of an album. She's very, very private.
Well, I remember loving that first record of hers back in the 80s. It was unlike anything I'd ever heard or knew of Irish music, especially. But I honestly admit I didn't really know that she kept making music. So who's buying her records now?
Oh, I think, you know, some people say that people who buy Enya are people who don't actually like music, as in, like, they don't have a lot of musical taste. They don't buy a lot of albums. But I don't think that that's necessarily true. I mean, my mom definitely bought all of these albums. I think a lot of people's parents buy these albums. But then again, like, you can talk to millennials today and all of them know Enya's music and it holds a place of significance in their lives. And, you know, in 2001, like, her biggest single was actually Only Time, which has been licensed in all sorts of commercials and lives a very vivid life today.
Yeah, that's what I think of her as, a little bit like Muzak now, something that works well in a car commercial or while you're Christmas shopping.
Yes, of course. But also, I think, you know, there's more sophistication there. Of all of the really popular people from what is sometimes dubbed this, like, new age period, so people like Yanni, who also was at the top of the charts kind of inexplicably for several years, you know, I don't think people listen to Yanni as much anymore, or like John Tesh's piano recordings. But Enya really endures.
There is this triad that continues to make that sound possible. You got a little bit of a glimpse of it. This is her inner circle, I guess, including the husband and wife production team who created that sound. Tell us a little bit about that relationship.
Oh, yes, they're very much a triad. And that's how they think of Enya, you know. The word, that's how you pronounce Enya's name, her Gaelic name. But they think of Enya, the group, as the three of them collaborating together. And, you know, part of the reason that I did this profile was really to highlight what had been elided in a lot of previous profiles, which is just how collaborative this process is. And Nikki, the husband, does all of the production and is really responsible for that layered sound that we associate with Enya. You know, she lays her voice down sometimes 500 times for a single track. And then Roma writes all of the lyrics.
So what do we know about her private life?
Almost nothing, besides that she lives in a castle. You know, our conversation really, we talked about all sorts of fascinating things about her childhood and about the way that she feels about classic movies and, you know, her favorite scales, you know, things that weren't necessarily not private, but she just thinks of success as a musician as a different thing than, you know, commodifying her personality. She thinks that that's really separate from, you know, talking about her music or appreciating her music, and that people can really love the sounds that she creates without knowing things about, you know, who she's dating.
Well, she is now 54. What did she tell you about her background? She grew up in Ireland during the Troubles, one of nine children or one of 10 children?
Nine children. And she, you know, is a musical family. She was in the very deep middle of the birth order and I think spent a lot of time not necessarily having a lot of choice about what she was doing. And she grew up in the northwest of Ireland in a place that's much more, I think, what we think of like gusty, blustery Ireland. And her family was in a singing group, Clannad, that was very popular in the 80s. Two of her uncles and several of her siblings. And she was part of that group for a short period of time as well. And then I think she was in her early 20s, transitioned into this kind of solo realm that we know today.
Well, you note that there are no photographs of Enya in pants or without her makeup that emphasizes her alabaster skin and dark eyes. And she wears a sort of Arthurian clothes. I mean, do you think she's cultivating this whole sort of, I don't know, ethereal Arthurian kind of reputation?
No, I think she actually just lives it. Like, I think, you know, we had this like an hour long conversation about the music that she really likes. I mean, she's very aware of people like Adele and that sort of thing. But she also, like, she loves opera and she loves Rachmaninoff. Like, those are the things that make her feel alive and present. And I think she spends a lot of time just focusing on the things that matter to her. And because of her success, she hasn't been forced to not focus on those things.
Which female musician has sold more records than Rihanna and Beyonce combined, is worth more than Chris Martin? It's Enya. She lives in a castle, never tours, puts out new records sporadically, and rarely talks to the press. But our guest, Anne Helen Peterson, did interview her and profiled Enya for BuzzFeed. Well, and there must be a real push from her record company to appeal to people in the digital age. You know, how is she doing in this sort of digital media realm?
I mean, to some extent, like, they've created a Twitter account for her, and she was very adamant that it not be represented as her tweeting, you know, having a ghost Twitter do the work for her. So, you know, it hasn't really caught on. I think it has like 5,000 followers because that's not how people conceive of her. And even you know, Warners, they really think of her as someone whose success is contingent upon a percentage of mystery. So I think that cultivating that mysticism is not necessarily anathema to what they're doing.
I've got to admit, I mean, looking at how she's managed things, and of course, she has been so successful that she's been able to do things her own way. But I think of this woman, she's shy, she doesn't like fame, she's had a few bad stalker experiences. No wonder she kind of hides out. But what does this suggest about what the industry actually knows of the record-buying public? I mean, are there a lot of people that are just being ignored by the newest publicity campaigns and social media campaigns?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think that a lot of people still really do like owning physical records, and that these reductive understandings of the idea that, like, oh, record buyer, like no one buys records anymore. No one listens to an entire album anymore. You know, that's a very limited understanding of the multiple ways that people consume music and enjoy music. And her success is proof that there are still these other ways that people seek out music.
So did it revive your love for Enya?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I listened to all of the albums on repeat in anticipation, and I really love the new album.
Anne Helen Peterson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Anne Helen Peterson is features writer for BuzzFeed, and her article, The Keys to Enya's Kingdom, is online at BuzzFeed. You'll find a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you're a fan of HBO programming, you may have heard the work of composer Max Richter. He's responsible for scoring one of its dark dramas, The Leftovers. But recently, Richter released something a little more subdued, an 8-hour album called Sleep, which he calls a lullaby for a frenetic world. Here's a bit from one of Sleep's 31 tracks. This is called Path 5. Ambitious as an 8-hour album may be, Max Richter is hardly the first composer to send people nodding off or to deliberately try to and score a dreamscape. Philip Sherburn is a contributing editor at Pitchfork magazine, where we found his article, Key of Z, The History of Sleep Music. And Philip, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia.
I have to admit, that just sounds so beautiful to me. But before we jump into its history, any sense of how popular this whole genre of sleep music is today?
Well, you know, it's funny because since I've written the article, I've really had people coming out of the woodwork, both friends of mine and just readers, to say how important to them sleep music, or the choosing the right music for sleep, actually was. So I think it is, it's very close to a lot of people's hearts. When I was researching the story, one of the things that surprised me was how many people are using streaming services as a kind of lullaby machine. Especially on Spotify, they have more than a dozen sleep-themed playlists and something like 3 million user-created playlists that are all devoted to sleep.
Wow. So would you call sleep music a genre in itself, or is it just pulling? It's like a collection of other new age psychedelica that gets used for this specific purpose.
Right. I think it's whatever gets you through the night, really. For a lot of people, it's going to be ambient music. I always used to listen to like Aphex Twin and things like that to go to sleep. In the Spotify study, the number one song on people's sleep music playlist was actually Ed Sheeran, who I think is sort of a soft pop artist.
Loving can hurt. Loving can hurt sometimes.
And then at the other end of the spectrum, just the other day, I read an interview with Rusty, who's a Scottish electronic music composer, and he says that he falls asleep to really fast, loud rave music. So it really comes down to personal preference.
I can imagine, you know, listening to something as you're lulling yourself to sleep, but your article writes about the sleep concert. So first of all, what is that? And when did the sleep concert get its start?
Well, this is a really interesting phenomenon. And as far as I could tell, they have their roots in the all-night concerts of the 1960s that minimalist composers like Terry Riley and Lamonte Young and Marion Zazeler were performing. They were concerts that had a lot to do with long duration and ritual and sort of an interest in non-Western cultures. The sleep concert as a format really seems to have come into its own in the 1970s. With specifically one composer named Rip Heyman. He was an interesting figure. He's out of New York. He had sort of Fluxus connections. He did these absurdist pieces. One was called Bell Roll, in which he donned a coat strung up with bells and he would roll down a hill. And so he became interested in sleep because he had a very vivid dream life, he said. He began organizing these all-night concerts with lavender and chamomile tea, and people were encouraged to fall asleep together and record their dreams. It was kind of almost a new age sort of thing.
It sounds like probably a little bit drug enhanced too.
My sense was that it actually wasn't drug enhanced. I know when I spoke to Robert Rich, who then sort of popularized the sleep concerts in the 80s, he was really adamantly sort of anti-psychedelics. He was interested in kind of listening as its own sort of psychedelic. He was very much interested in presence.
Well, let's hear just a bit from Terry Riley, one of those you mentioned, you know, part of this whole kind of happenings, be-ins, the Fluxus movement of the 1960s. This is a bit from an 18-minute track called A Rainbow in Curved Air. Terry Riley, the minimalist composer's A Rainbow in Curved Air. A little bit more frenetic, obviously, maybe more like REM sleep. But what do you think is at the heart of this connection between music and sleep, or maybe even dreams?
Part of it is a communal thing. A lot of the people that I spoke to really emphasized that these sleep concerts specifically were about people coming together and experiencing something collectively. I spoke with a curator in Portugal named Pedro Rocha, and he said something to the effect that sleep concerts weren't something you could experience. You couldn't film them with your phone. You know, you had to be there, and you had to kind of give yourselves over to them, which I think is something that a lot of people maybe are craving, that sort of connection. You know, we're all sort of frazzled, we're all sort of distracted, and I think the idea of really, you know, putting your phone away and rolling out your sleeping bag and giving yourself over to the event for the night is appealing for that reason.
So you think that's why there's a little bit of a resurgence in interest in this now?
I think so. I know a few years ago at the Unsound Festival in Krakow, they invited Robert Rich to bring back the sleep concerts, which he'd stopped doing decades before. He's done them now again at the Red Bull Music Academy in Japan and elsewhere.
And Max Richter is doing these concerts as well. Are people showing up?
I know that for the album release party for his new album, which is the 8-hour composition, they did that as an all-night concert. And I believe that was a sellout event, full up. I don't know if he's continuing to do them, but I know the event at Unsound Festival in Krakow was also a sellout. I didn't go because at the time I was sort of nervous about the idea. Now I wish that I had.
Well, let's hear a bit from another recent sleep-themed album. This is from Jeff Bridges, the actor and sometime musician. His album is called Sleeping Tapes. This is a bit from Hum. Jeff Bridges from the album Sleeping Tapes. And I'm wondering, Philip, you review these, you know, how do you think our evaluation of music changes when there is a specific purpose behind it? I mean, how do you review a sleep album if you're supposed to listen to it while passed out?
Well, I guess, you know, you can look on a sort of a functional level. Does it get you there? Does it get you past the gates? And with the Jeff Bridges album, I don't think it actually works as a sleep album because he's so personable. It's kind of hard to resist his appeal. I would have trouble actually falling asleep to that. I want to hear the jokes. I think the Max Richter is much more sort of suited to that sort of deep relaxation, you know, these very slow movements that they put you right out.
Well, Philip, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Philip Sherburn, he's contributing editor to Pitchfork magazine. There's a link to his article on the history of sleep with plenty of musical examples. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd like to know if you are the type to go to bed with music in the background. What is your go-to sleep soundtrack? Share your picks and post them on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio.
My name is Megan Tan. I am a producer at Word of Mouth, and my go-to sleep song is Iron and Wine, Trapeze Swinger.
Please remember me.
Because it's beautiful, it's long, it's 10 minutes, somebody's like singing you a lullaby. It's also like the good sad song. Like the sad song you want to hear when you kind of want to feel sad and you also want to go to sleep.
We counted every black car passing your house.
Hi, I'm Morgan McMurray. I'm the executive producer of Word of Mouth, and my go-to sleep album is Gaucho by Steely Dan. Because it's Steely Dan, it's like you can just get lulled by Fagan's voice, and their lyrics are, you know, seemingly upbeat, but there's a darkness there, so you could have some nightmares. And just the production value is super sleepy, yacht rockish, and I mean that in a very good way.
Hi, I'm Taylor Quimby. I'm a producer with Word of Mouth. And my go-to sleep album is by Sunkill Moon. It's called Tiny Cities. And it's a whole album of Modest Mouse covers, but it's like very acoustic, heavy reverb on the vocals, kind of sad, but mostly beautiful.
Gonna punch you in your glasses, oh no. Just got a message, said yeah, hell is free.
There's like a couple tracks where the drums get a little too loud and kind of wake you up, but for the most part, it's perfect for sleep.
I'm Molly Donahue, and I'm a producer with Word of Mouth, and my go-to sleep song isn't a song. I would say it's the BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm Jerry Smith with the BBC News. Argentina is ending the foreign exchange restrictions that have prompted up the...
You know, it's always on at late night. I don't think I've ever really been fully awake while listening to a BBC World Service report. Yeah, just reminds me of very early mornings.
Killed the goose that laid the golden egg by restricting the growth of the economy.
I'm Logan Shannon. I'm a producer with Word of Mouth, and my favorite sleep song is the soundtrack to Amelie. Specifically, the tracks from Jan Tiersen, the instrumental tracks. It's the album I always bring on a plane if I need to sort of relax and sleep, because it lulls me to sleep, but it also reminds me of the movie, and it's one of my favorite movies, and it always sort of relaxes me.
Okay, it's time to wake up and get jolly. Or if you're experiencing jolly fatigue, maybe a chance to get downright opinionated. We are more than a little surprised at the turns that Word of Mouth's first annual holiday song bracket have taken. Some classics have fallen by the wayside. Take that, Frank Sinatra. While others have emerged as new classics. The penultimate round of voting is on, so take a moment now to weigh in on the face-off between Nat King Cole's O Holy Night with Bing Crosby's White Christmas. Or She and Him doing Baby It's Cold Outside, taking on Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas by Sam Smith. We're leaving the vote open over the weekend, and we'll announce the winner on Monday. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
I've got to go away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
The evening has been
hoping that you drop in.
So very nice.
I'll hold your hands, they're just like
my mother will start to worry.